I want to ask you to open your Bibles, not to the passage that's up there on the chart, but to Malachi chapter 2, verses 13 through 16 for the text of our lesson this morning. Malachi is the last book of the Old Testament, and so turn over to Malachi, to the prophet Malachi, chapter 2, verses 13 through 16. We introduced this passage in our study last week, and I want to take this as the passage that we'll use as our text. Malachi prophesied to the Jews who had returned from Babylonian captivity. He's the last of the Old Testament prophets. And at the time that Malachi prophesied, the Jews had once again become hardened in their attitudes toward God. And Malachi, for the Lord, would make an accusation against them, and they would act like spoiled children. They would say, well, how have we done that? And then Malachi would tell them how they had done that. So it's a series of exchanges as Malachi speaks for the Lord. Now, with that in mind, let's read together Malachi chapter 2, verses 13 through 16. Now, this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears. So when they went to make their sacrifices, the altar where they made the sacrifice was covered with tears. Well, how is that? With weeping and crying, so he does not regard the offering anymore, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands. So what they were doing was causing the Lord to reject their sacrifices. Well, what were they doing? Yet you say, for what reason? See, they're like spoiled. Oh, how did I do that? For what reason? Why? How have I covered the altar of the Lord with tears? And why does he reject my sacrifice? He says, because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth. Now, the first thing I want to see is when a marriage takes place, a marriage that has God's approval, then there is a witness to that. Now, we in our society, we have a best man and a maid of honor, and technically their role is to be the witnesses to the wedding. But really, there's a witness above that we don't see, and that witness is God. He's the witness between you and the wife of your youth with whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion, you've dealt treacherously to your closest companion, and your wife by covenant. The second thing I want to see is that when we enter into a marriage relationship, this is a covenant relationship. A covenant is a contract, and the contract involves agreement on the part. In fact, we're going to find three things involved in this contract as we go ahead. But a person made a promise, and that promise is a very formal promise that in the Old Testament times would have included an oath and witness to these things. And God is the witness. And in this contract that you've made, you're not keeping your contract. What was happening here, and we mentioned this last time, is that there were fellows who were getting old, but so were their wives getting old, the wife of their youth, and they had rather smell perfume than liniment. And so they were putting away their old wives to marry young wives. They were dealing treacherously with the wife of their youth. But notice what God says about this in verse 15. Did he not make them one? Now that goes back to Genesis chapter 2. God made the man and the woman to be one flesh and having a remnant of the Spirit. And why one? He seeks godly offspring. We'll talk about that later on. As one of the points, one of the purposes of marriage is for procreation. But the reason God made them one flesh is that there might be godly offspring from that marriage. Therefore, take heed to your spirit. Have the right attitude, you say. And let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. Quit putting away your old wives, the one that you married when you were young. And quit dealing treacherously with your companion, your closest companion, and the one who is your wife by covenant. For the Lord God of Israel says he hates divorce. By the way, God's not changed his mind about that. From the very beginning, God has always hated divorce. And he still does. For it covers one's garment with violence, says Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. Three times he accused them of dealing treacherously. Divorcing without the one scriptural cause is dealing treacherously with your companion, and the one who is your companion by covenant. We'll say more about that as we get into the lesson. I forwarded some emails to those of you this week who receive emails. I don't know if you paid attention to those or not. I a lot of times just delete forwards. But at any rate, what's going on in the city of Houston right now is an illustration of the very bad situation that's come about so far as the attitude that the leaders and most people in our country have towards the marriage relationship. And you may remember that but what's been going on in Houston is this. The city fathers, the city mother and the fathers, passed an ordinance that's supposed to protect gay rights. And one of the things of this ordinance is that you can go into any bathroom you want to. It's not going to be segregated by sexes anymore. And if a man decides he's a woman that day, he can go into the woman's bathroom. Now, if a woman decides she's a man that day, she can go into the man's bathroom. Well, the people of the city of Houston, yeah, I got some weird looks on that. It was kind of weird, wasn't it? And the people of the city of Houston decided they didn't want that. And so it takes 17,000 signatures. Now, I'm not trying to get into politics. This is illustration of the state of disregard for the marriage relationship that's come about in our country today. So the citizens of the city of Houston, it takes 17,000 signatures to put something on the ballot to be voted on by the people. They got 50,000 signatures. And the city official who was charged with saying that this was a valid petition said, yep, they're valid signatures, and this can go before the people. But the mayor of the city, who is a lesbian, didn't want that. And so she got somebody else saying, no, there's not enough, and they kicked it off the ballot. And now the mayor of the city has gotten the city attorney to send a subpoena to five pastors there in the city of Houston they want to review what they've been preaching on homosexuality. And then the Texas State Attorney General said, you don't have the right to do that. It's a violation of the First Amendment. And so they changed it. They said, well, we don't want your sermons, we want your speeches. As if there's a difference between a preacher's sermon and a preacher's speech. It's one of the self-same thing. Of course, what they're trying to do is to bully those. And by the way, those pastors that have been subpoenaed, they were no part of that petition. It's just simply a bullying process they're going through. But what now, that all aside, that is a very graphic illustration that ought to get our attention, to get us to see what's going on in our country, the total disregard for what the Lord says concerning the marriage relationship. But listen carefully to me, please. That began a long, long time ago. In the notes, and if you don't have those notes, there's some more laying out on the table. If they all get picked up, I can run off some more. In the notes that I handed out to you, there's some quotes that I'm not going to go into from a book written by a man that did a marvelous job of researching this. And everything that he said is backed up by great research from a historical standpoint and from a sociological standpoint. Since about 100 years ago, and I did not realize until I read this book that this had been going on that long, our country has been getting more and more away. You go back to what's called the Victorian era, and that was both in our country and in England. And at that time, some high standards were set up. Yes, there were hypocrites, but you know what people will do today, look back at high standards and just try to find some hypocrites. There were some high standards, and people who passed the laws concerning marriage relationship in our country had the philosophy that marriage is the building block of the society. And if you're going to have citizens that are upright and able to conduct public business, you need to have strong marriages. And we know biblically that's the case, that the marriage relationship is the bedrock both of the nation and of the church. The first divine institution. And that's the attitude they had, but things have been going awry for 100 years now. And finally, during the 60s and the 60s revolution, it all came to a head. And in 1969 is when the beginning of the no-fault divorce. And you don't have to prove anything wrong. By the way, Arkansas does not have that law. Most states have no-fault divorce. But in Arkansas, you have to find some reason for it. But at any rate, they passed the no-fault divorce laws and just go down and say, I don't want to have... You're in a covenant relationship. You made a promise till death do you part. And all you have to do to rip that home apart and to have kids without two parents is to say, well, I don't want to do this and I'm not happy. And that's what most people, not just city officials, not just government officials, most people in our country approve that. Well, that's been going on for a long time, but it's finally gotten to the point, well, the gays demand, look, if you're going to have what you have concerning the marriage relationship, where it's just as long as you're happy together, and if you decide you're not happy together, you can break that covenant and go your own way, then why couldn't we be a part of that? And that's what's happening in our country. And that's what the Supreme Court refused to take a look at. And as the result, all 50 states will have gay marriage. And when that happens, what's already happened, then what was predicted by the sociologists 40 years ago has come about. Marriage as we know it, from a legal standpoint, has been destroyed in our country because the majority of the people in our country just frankly are more interested in doing what makes them happy for the moment than they are in following the will of the Lord. So we're going to find out more about God's will. Now, marriage relationship, as we found from Malachi chapter 2, is a covenant relationship, a contract. When you enter into a contract, there are some conditions you have to meet, and you make a promise that you're going to do this. And in the marriage relationship, if I perform the wedding ceremony, and if Brother Joe Davis performs the wedding ceremony, it's till death do you part. You made a promise. You made that promise before God. You made that promise before human witnesses. And it's the most solemn promise. Well, you'll never make a more solemn promise than that. And you make it to the person ought to be the closest person in your life, the one with whom you become one flesh. That's what happens when you enter the marriage relationship. Now, there's some conditions. These conditions are not humanly set. They are divinely set. We must obey God rather than man. Human laws may just throw these out the window and say it doesn't matter, but God doesn't do that, and it still matters. And if we throw it out the window and say it doesn't matter, then we're going to lose our souls. We must obey God rather than man. Now, see, it's a covenant relationship. Malachi chapter 2, verse 14. And in this covenant relationship, God sets some conditions for what is an acceptable marriage. In the first place, it's one man and one woman. And that is so plainly stated, for example, in 1 Corinthians, it's not the only place, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 2. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Now that's a very clear and specific statement. First of all, if you take that without any other qualifying verses, if there are no other verses in the Bible, then every woman has the right to be married and every man has the right to be married. But a man only has the right to be married to a woman, and it's one man to one woman. A woman only has the right to be married to a man, and it's one woman to one man. Now, you just take it for what it says. If that's the only passage in the Bible, any man and any woman can be married as long as that man marries a woman and that woman marries a man. But there's more to the Bible than that as far as qualifying it. Now we go to Mark chapter 10, verses 11 and 12, where Jesus is talking about divorce. The Pharisees have asked him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for any reason? He's answering their question. And he says to them, now actually he's talking to his disciples here. He said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And whatever, if a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Now, if that was the only passage of the Bible dealing with divorce, then no divorced person who had a living former mate would have the right to marry. Unless there's an exception to that, because Jesus said, if you're married, you divorce, and you marry again, you're living in adultery. He says that both for the man and for the woman in Mark 10, 11, and 12. And so if there's no other passage in the Bible dealing with it, then no divorced person has the right to remarry. But there's one other passage we need to look at. These are the conditions of the contract. Now this is the divine condition. This is what God says about it. And Matthew chapter 19, verse 9. Listen carefully. This is the only passage in the Bible which gives anyone who is divorced and has a living former mate. Did you hear that? Those qualifications? This is the only passage in the Bible who gives anyone who is divorced and has a living former mate the right to remarry. If Matthew 19:9 is not in the Bible, then no divorced person with a living former mate has the right to marry. But Matthew 19:9 is there. But it's very specific in whom it allows to remarry. Now I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality. Now the old King James, rightfully so, has the word fornication there. And a sexual immorality is okay, but I like the word fornication because that's a more specific... Sexual immorality, my way of thinking, would include going to an R-rated or a dirty movie. That'd be sexual immorality. But that's not what fornication is. Fornication is unlawful sexual relationships of any kind. See, Jesus used the general word. It's usually more broad than the word adultery. Adultery, by its narrow definition, is married people having sexual relationship with somebody other than their lawful mate. But fornication is the more general word, and it includes homosexuality. So practicing homosexual sex is reason for somebody to put away that guilty mate and to remarry. And so it's the more general word. And so whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. So the only person who is divorced, who has a living former mate, who has the right to remarry, is the innocent party who put away their mate because the mate was guilty of sexual immorality, guilty of fornication. Now that's the divine conditions of the covenant, of the contract, of an acceptable marriage in the sight of God. No other meets the conditions of that divine covenant, that contract. And then there is concord. There's the mutual agreement. A man and a woman agree that they will be husband and wife. This is illustrated by Joseph and Mary. She was betrothed. She was promised to him. But they had not yet come together as husband and wife. We know from Matthew chapter 1. That betrothal, or that what we would call engagement, was so formal in that day that it took a divorce to break it. But nonetheless, although she was betrothed or promised to him, they had agreed to get married, they had not yet come together, husband and wife. She says, I know not a man, which of course is a euphemism. She had not had sexual relations with Joseph at that point. So she was promised to him, they'd agreed to get married, but they hadn't gotten married yet. And so there is the concord, there is the agreement, and the third thing that makes the covenant is the confirmation. There must be some way that this covenant is formally ratified. And that's the very term that is used by the Apostle Paul. Now in Galatians chapter 3, Paul is simply talking about a covenant of any kind. And since marriage is a covenant, Malachi chapter 2 verse 14, then this does apply to the marriage relationship. But in Galatians chapter 3 verse 15, Paul says, brethren, I speak after in the manner of men, though it is only a man's covenant or contract, yet if it is confirmed or ratified, then no one annuls, that is, makes it void, or adds to it. Now that is directly in conflict with what goes on in our country today. No fault divorce. Either one. I don't want to be married anymore. I'm not happy. Or I found somebody I like better. Or she burned the toast. Or he has bad breath. Or whatever it is. Well, for whatever reason you can bring up, then I decide I want to break this contract. That is in direct conflict with what the apostle, once you have made a promise, till death do you part. It's been confirmed. Then you don't annul it. You don't break it. You don't even change it. It stays the way it was set up. Nobody has the right to change, to do away with, to annul, or to change a ratified covenant. And of course, Jesus showed by going and performing His first miracle at the wedding in Cana of Galilee, His approval of the wedding as the formal confirmation of. And of course, the kinds of wedding, that differs from society to society. But there must be some kind of a confirmation of that. When those three things take place, when you meet the divine conditions, and when both agree that we're going to be married, we're going to be husband and wife, and when that covenant is confirmed, when it is ratified, then that couple are husband and wife. They're joined together. And what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. There's some consequences of that. If that is broken, and they go and marry another, then they become an adulterer or an adulteress. Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 6, the Pharisees also came to Him, testing Him and saying to Him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? That's what's done in our country today. And by the way, let me add something here too. And I'm not going to give... You would be shocked if I would tell you the names of some preachers that are now advocating this. Divorce for virtually any cause under the sun. Editors of magazines among brethren are advocating this. Divorce for virtually any cause under the sun. It's so sad. The men who are doing this are old friends of mine that I've known for years and years. And it just breaks my heart to see them doing this. They're doing away with the covenant that God set up. We can't do that. This is a divine covenant. God is the witness to it. God is the one who set the conditions. What God has joined together, let not man separate. Why then did Moses command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? He said, from the beginning it was not so. And so, they're no longer two but one flesh. What God has joined together, do not let man separate. It is the height of insolent presumption for a human to break apart what God joined together. We don't have the right to do it. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4, the inspired writer says, marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. Of course, that's a euphemism for the sexual relationship and the marriage relationship, the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. Many years ago, I was teaching a teenage Bible class, had a young smart aleck in that class. His name was Keith. I don't know if that had anything to do with it. But at any rate, he held up his hand and he said, Brother Sharp, if sex is all right inside marriage, why is it wrong outside of marriage? He thought that was going to shock me. Now, how would you answer that question? If sex is all right in marriage, why is it wrong outside of marriage? Would you go through a long thing about the results of it and so forth? All I did was quote to him Hebrews 13, verse 4. By the way, it shut him up. Hebrews 13, verse 4. Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. End of story. No more to be said. That ends it. That's God's plan, and nothing is to change that. All right. There's three purposes. I'm going to try to hit these quickly because I don't want to go to a third sermon or a third time of going over this. But there's three purposes. One is marriage relation, is companionship. This is the first purpose of the marriage relationship, is to have a companion, your closest companion. It is not good that the man should be alone. Genesis 2:18. I will make him a helper comparable to him. I made the point last week. I've had some pet dogs that I really loved, Dixie was my favorite. She could fetch a stick with the best of them, but she couldn't carry on a conversation. No dogs are ever going to be my best friend. My wife is my best friend, and that's the way it must be if we're pleasing to God. And so we have companionship as the first reason. Then procreation. In Genesis 1, 27 and 28, God told the man and the woman, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And of course, that is given in more detail in Genesis 2, 18 to 24. It's the beginning of the marriage relationship. And he said the same thing to the sons of Noah in Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. At that time, the earth was empty of people, and so they had to fill the earth. And that's what is the marriage relationship is, procreation. But there's more than just having kids. And by the way, that's not the only purpose for the marriage relationship. Now, the Catholics teach that that's the only purpose of a marriage relationship is having kids, and so you can't practice birth control. The Bible doesn't teach that. Companionship is the first purpose of it. But it's also, there is procreation, there's bringing children. But what kind of children? Is any kind of children? You have some notes in your, on the outline that I handed out that shows the results of divorce on children. Do you know that testing has proven, and I'm talking about surveys of the results of divorce on children, that a divorce is harder on children than the death of a parent? I'm going to repeat that. I'm going to think about that. Divorce is harder on children than the death of a parent. Selfish parents are subjecting their children to awful things that they should not be subjected to. Those children are precious. And the reason God put children in marriage is so there would be a godly seed. And their chances are much, much better in turning out to be fine young people if they have their biological mother and their biological father, their parents. That's the best chance that children have turning out right. By the way, no orphanage can compete with that. And certainly no breaking up and having a step-parent in the home. Now, don't misunderstand me. There's sometimes that scriptural, the only thing that can be done. But it makes it very difficult on the children. Now, I've got some statistics in there. Child abuse, real child abuse, is 40 times as likely with a stepfather than with a biological father. The murder of a child is 70 times more likely with a stepfather than with a biological father. You think God knew what He's doing when He said, one man, one woman, one flesh for life? God knew exactly what He's doing, and that's the way He wants it. So there will be a godly seed. If we want to have good children who will make good citizens of the country and will become faithful Christians, we need to have dedicated mothers and daddies who are going to work through whatever problems they have and live before their children and teach their children and be what they ought to be before their children, so their children can turn out to be the kind of young people that we want to have. And a third reason for marriage is to avoid fornication. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 2. We've already used this passage to avoid. Because of fornication, let every man have his own wife, and every woman her own husband. And take with that Hebrews 13, 4, we've already looked at. And so procreation is not the only reason for the sexual relationship, the marriage relationship. It's also so that we can avoid fornication. The Lord's been very specific on what it takes to compose a marriage relationship. The number of mates, one woman, one man. In other words, no polygamy. And as you've heard before, it's not Adam and Steve, it's Adam and Eve. And by the way, I might add to that, it's not Anne and Eve, it's Adam and Eve. It's not two women, it's not two men, one woman for life, until death do you part. Matthew 19, verses 4 through 6, look at it, it's very specific, very plain. He answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them after the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. One man, one woman, become one flesh for life. That's simple, isn't it? And that he meant what he said. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And again, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 2, to avoid sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, each woman her own husband. How long is it to last? It's till death do you part. It's a lifetime. It's not until I'm not happy here anymore. It's not until I find somebody I like more. It's until death do you part. Romans chapter 7, verse 2. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. The same thing is taught in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 39. Now, if we follow God's plan, what will be the result? I found it interesting. I may bring this out in a future lesson, either an article or a sermon. As more and more people are getting away from the divine plan for marriage, one man, one woman for life, one flesh for life, more and more, and this is borne out by studies, there is a decrease of the happiness, not just of the man, not just of the woman, but both of the woman and the man over a period of years, as there's been more and more divorce, as there's been more and more getting away from the divine plan, you can just see it graphed. The happiness of the man and the woman in the married relationship goes down, down. You know, the thing about it is, people today is, well, what makes me happy? I'm going to do what makes me... Oh, you can't expect me to be unhappy. Listen carefully, please. Yes, you may have to go through life unhappy in order to spend eternity happy. You may go through life happy and spend eternity unhappy. Yes, if doing what it takes to obey God proves unhappy now, do you think the first century Christians went through any suffering? Do you think they were always happy with everything that went on in their lives? God expects us to obey Him regardless of the consequences now, in order that we might have happiness for eternity. But the simple fact is, in most cases, by simply following God's plan, God said it is not good that the man should be alone. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 25 through 28, we read about God making this is the sixth day of creation, and Genesis 2 goes into more detail the sixth day of creation. And God made all the animals. And we know from Genesis chapter, all the animals had their own mates. And God said, God looked at this and said, it's good. That's in verse 25. And then He made the man and the woman. And we know from Genesis 2, 18 through 24, that included bringing them together as husband and wife and making the marriage relationship. And after He had done that, in verse 31 it says, God saw it was very good. Now, after He'd made all the animals, it was good. But after He'd made the man and the woman in His own image, both the man and the woman in the image of God, brought them together, husband and wife, and began the marriage relationship, then He said it was very good. What's the difference between the good and the very good? The difference is the man and the woman, one flesh, husband and wife. Then God's good creation was very good. It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. And God set it up in such a way that if we will submit our will to His will and just do what He tells us to do, we will have not only a life that's pleasing to God, not only a life that will cause us to be happy for eternity, but we will have a life that is happy now. Proverbs 18:22. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Oh, there's exceptions. Proverbs are general statements. Sometimes a fellow finds a wife that's not a good thing, and sometimes a woman finds a husband that's not a good thing. But the general truth is, He who finds a wife obtains favor, finds a good thing, obtains favor from the Lord, because that is the way for most people to have a happy, fulfilling life here, to have children who will be godly and walk in the steps of the Master, and for all who are involved to be prepared to spend eternity in heaven. There may be somebody in the audience who needs to make your life right with God. The song of encouragement, number 266.